The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
World Cup Football Daily with James Richardson.
Why is Luis Suarez like a high-speed modem? Because he gets good access to the net and he's got loads of bites. Yes! Football Daily reviews a remarkable Tuesday of action, one that brought shock and surprise across the world as England record a clean sheet and Suarez bites Chiellini. What's the difference between Italy at the World Cup and Andy Coulson? Italy couldn't hack it. We've got reaction to all the Group D and Group C finale games. Then we look ahead to Wednesday. Another eight teams battling to stay in the greatest cup in the world. Everybody, this is going to be an amazing World Cup Football Daily. Let's just turn that down a bit. There we go. Ian McCourt.
Hey, Jimbo.
Jaunty Ian McCourt. Good to see you back.
Oh, thank you very much.
Back-to-back appearances.
Nice to be back.
Well, yeah. And hey, Simon Burnton, you're back as well.
I am.
I'm not telling you anything you don't know.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Listeners, he is anyway. And in the flesh, Mikael Jongsma.
Hey, James.
Hey, amazing, you know, because you were only a disembodied stat-powered voice. And now here you are, manifest. Boom. And we've got some special stats for you, actually, because I know you like a stat at benefit.net. But we've got some pretty... I think Simon's got a whole page of them, haven't you, Simon?
Oh, I'm quite curious.
I have a couple of statistics, mainly
brilliant.
mainly meaningless.
Oh, good.
They're the best kind.
Exactly so. Ian McCourt, you're the kind of crazy guy who probably regularly frequents Baile Funk parties.
I wouldn't say regularly frequents, but on a trip to Brazil a few years ago, me and some friends did make our way to the favela and to the funk party.
Right, okay. Please let the daughter of Christa Burr be one of those friends.
She wasn't.
No way!
No.
All right. Now, so many things to talk about today. I think we've got to start with the action from Group D, no? Obviously, Costa Rica played England and Italy-Uruguay. It was a bit controversial.
Yeah, I think mainly because we've been averaging 3.5 goals a game in this World Cup, and all of a sudden in
that's
today's
why
Group
it was
D,
controversial.
We averaged 0.25 goals a game.
Right.
And so everyone's up in arms about this.
Right.
So, yeah, very controversial.
There was another incident at the end as well.
What happened at the end?
Luis Suarez took a chunk out of
his
shoulder.
All right. Huffington Post going with Chewy Lewis and the Blues. Gotta like that. Thomas Hegarty, someone should have told Suarez it's Chiellini, not Cannelloni. I respect what you're doing there. But it was absolutely extraordinary. Could you believe it when you saw, Mikael?
I really haven't seen it, to be honest.
Have you not seen it?
I was watching the England-Costa Rica game, which probably not the popular vote for most people.
Right.
But, I was engaging into some England football today.
Right, they're very dedicated to you. Well, Simon, tell Mikael what happened.
Well, there was a bit of a coming together in the penalty area, obviously, between Chiellini and Suarez. There didn't seem to be any enormous amount of premeditation. It was just that he found his mouth in the vicinity of an opponent's shoulder and just couldn't resist. And I'm not sure we've learned anything new about Suarez today. I'm not sure. I don't find that my opinion of him has changed at all. I mean, he's the beauty and the beast. And if we were prepared to accept him a week ago or a month ago, then we're surely prepared to accept him now. I don't see what's changed. I mean, he's just done what he has done before. And as he did against England, we saw one side against England and another side today. We know they both exist. And, you know, we either accept him as a player, as an entirety, or we don't. And I think that we have.
Well, until now, maybe there'd been a desire, perhaps because he's such a great player, to believe that he had made a mistake and that he wasn't going to do it again. But that option's not really there anymore, perhaps. I don't know. Will he feature at all? Do you think, Ian, in the rest of this World Cup, are FIFA going to take a stand?
I think they will take a stand. They have to, don't they? So I doubt he will. And that will be curtains for Uruguay, because they face Colombia. Yeah, Colombia will do them.
All right. Hey, a lot of respect for the Norwegian. No, was it Norwegian?
Yeah.
For the Scandinavian, Norwegian.
He won £500 on it. He bet that Suarez would bite somebody at the World Cup and won £500 for it.
Is that all he got for it?
Yeah.
All right.
But it'll be interesting to see. I mean, we have to assume that FIFA will discipline him, as they should.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be astonished if he plays in the World Cup, in this World Cup again. But what the record ban that FIFA have retrospectively imposed on a player at the World Cup was was as a result of Mauro Tassotti's elbow on Luis Enrique in 94. And that was an incident of incomparably greater violence and a greater risk of injury, and actual injury for that matter. And if you ban someone for 8 matches for a vicious swing of the elbow that cracked somebody's nose, I mean, biting is weird. It is weird, but there was no injury, actual or potential, in what Suarez did today. And I think it's a very difficult balance to strike, disciplinarily. But I think that if there is a ban of longer than 8 matches, longer than that Tassotti received, I think that would be weird and inexplicable.
Mm. This season is turning out to be a really great advert for the services of Dr. Steve Peters in the meanwhile, isn't it? What with Steven Gerrard and Luis Suarez and that. In amongst all the goodbyes, no more Buffon, probably, and Pirlo, definitely, at a World Cup.
Buffon's still got it, though, hasn't he?
Mm.
He still pulled off some couple really of great saves today, and his reactions are still
in 4
good.
Years' time, even he, surely.
But he can still play.
Well, Pirlo, then. Pirlo has said he's hanging up his Azzurri shirt and hanging up his heart, he says, at the end of this World Cup.
I think Pirlo goes down as possibly the greatest player I've ever seen live.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. You know, goes alongside Iniesta and Messi and players like that. He's just astounding to see.
All right. I'm going to suggest, and we were talking about this a little bit before, that Italy never recovered from their first game in Manaus. So, Ian, you were saying they ran a lot of kilometres more than England did. In fact, arguably neither England nor Italy, both of whom looked good going into that game and during that game, and afterwards were utterly drained in their next 2 matches. And it makes you think about this notion of playing a World Cup in Qatar, but that, of course, is a subject for another day.
Everyone expected that first match to be a mutually beneficial 0-0 draw. It was going to be the hot one, the humid one. The teams would just play it slow, see out a 0-0 draw, and take the group as it came from there. Instead, they attacked each other with a surprising vigour, and perhaps they've paid. Perhaps they should have played out that 0-0 draw.
Mm, maybe so. Well, among the goodbyes, also the Italy manager, Cesare Prandelli, who has fallen very much on his sword post-game. Paolo Bandini was there at the stadium and indeed at the post-game press conference. Paolo Bandini.
Hello. Hey. How are you?
Yeah, we're very well here. We want to hear all about your ringside seat at history.
Ringside seat of history, is that the negative kind of 2 World Cups out in a row, first time since 1966 for Italy history, or...
Well, that's part of it.
Seeing Luis Suarez bite on someone, not for the first time in history.
Yeah. That's the kind of history I was talking about. But just a crazy finale to a pretty bizarre game, Paolo.
Yeah, it was actually really not a very entertaining game for a long time. I felt like in the first half, it was almost like Italy had set themselves up not to lose, but even though Uruguay needed to win, they'd also set themselves up not to lose. So it was sort of a slow burner, and then obviously after Marchisio got sent off, things all got a lot more lively very quickly, and a little bit of both ends. But it was just a game that was defined by that incident, I think, and unfortunately, and unfortunately for me at the time, anyway. It was a game that didn't feel like it was inevitably going one way or the other, but just that it was heading towards some sort of grand conclusion, and then that sending off happened, and it all broke open a little bit.
Yeah. Well, Italy go out now with that 1-0 defeat. Their headline this morning of the Gazzetta was "No, a casa no," which I think gives you a little bit of a window of the kind of pre-match anxiety the Azzurri were feeling. Presumably in the press box, people weren't aware of what Suarez had done. When they saw the replays afterwards, what was the reaction there?
No, at the end of the game all got mad very quickly, because obviously we had, I think we could see that there'd been some sort of collision, and then we saw that Suarez went down, and We have little monitors in the press area in the stand, so we could see that there had been some sort of collision. At first glance, it looked more like he was trying to butt him. But the more we looked at it, the more suspicions arose, and then everyone was beginning to get emails from back home with people who had the full-on TV coverage and could have a good look at it, telling us that this had gone on. And so suddenly the story that was being written, that we were all writing our stories up there, and the story that was being written for everybody changed very quickly. And for the Italian journalists, it took one swing, and then it took a whole second swing when they got to the press conference and Prandelli walked out and announced immediately that he'd resigned.
Mm. Yeah, indeed. So he's gone, and the head of the Italian FA has gone as well.
Yeah, he has. It was a bit of a strange one, because Prandelli made this announcement, and Alberto was sat right there next to him. And one of the Italian journalists basically responded to Prandelli saying he resigned by saying, "Well, Alberto, he's just resigned, but are you going to accept this resignation, or are you going to refuse it?" At which point, Alberto, it almost felt like he was stealing his thunder a little bit. He suddenly goes, "Well, I don't think that, I'm going to go and talk to him. I don't think that Cesare should resign. I hope he changes his mind. But actually, I'm resigning as well." And it went on this huge, long conversation about not just the fact that he was resigning, but absolutely everyone he intended to speak to about this and everything that he was planning to do to tee up his successor. It sort of became a five-minute-long soliloquy, it felt like. But it was a strange moment when that happened, but it was certainly a jarring moment to see Prandelli resign, because for me, I would absolutely agree that he's made mistakes in this World Cup. I think it doesn't speak well to him that he's gone into this crucial game in the end and with two strikers that he said himself before the tournament couldn't really or weren't well suited to playing together. It felt a little bit like that was an issue perhaps of him folding the public pressure of knowing that if he went out of this tournament without playing Immobile, that was going to be the thing that people were going to hit him with. But it was a shame to me to see him go, because I really feel like for, even if he, maybe in footballing terms wasn't getting things right at the end, he's really a manager who brought back such an optimism to Italy for such a long time, who tried to do things the right way, who tried to have training matches on, these things get said a few times, I guess, have those training matches on pitches reclaimed from crime syndicates, brought players into the squad to train with them for after they'd been whistleblowers in the match-fixing cases. He really tried to do a lot of things the right way as Italy manager, and it just unraveled for him a little bit at the end. It was a jarring moment to see him up there and eating humble pie, I guess.
There were all sorts of interesting things said post-game, Simon.
Well, for a start, Chiellini challenged FIFA to act. He suggested that FIFA don't like acting against the big stars because it's the big stars that project the image of the World Cup that FIFA want people to see. And he kind of challenged FIFA to act against Suarez, even though he's one of the potential stars of the tournament. And then there was Diego Lugano, the Uruguayan captain, who launched an astonishing attack on Chiellini himself. Said that the worst of everything is the attitude of Chiellini, he said. As a sportsman leaving the field crying and appealing against a rival, as a man, he disappointed me totally. Incredible stuff. He's asked reporters, what do you think? What did you see? Did you see what he did today, or did you see what happened in other years? You couldn't have seen it today because nothing happened.
Well, there you go. All right, well, that could almost be your two-word match report on Costa Rica-England, a game which you watched, Mikhail.
Yeah, it was quite similar to the other two England games played, I think, because they actually showed some nice football and some vigor, some youthful enthusiasm. But overall, that you never really felt that they got a grip on the game. And Costa Rica looked quite dangerous on the break a few times.
Mm. They did indeed, but England kept a clean sheet. Added some fresh young players.
There were a couple of decent performances. Luke Shaw, I thought, looked pretty good. Barkley in fits and starts. He does give the ball away a bit too much for my liking. We had chances. Sturridge had several chances. One particularly good chance set up by Rooney that fell perfectly on his left foot, and he should have scored. But there you go. It's just been the kind of World Cup where, if you compare, England's World Cup to Uruguay's. Godin could have been sent off against England, obviously, and then he ends up scoring the goal that sends them through to the next round with his back. The ball bounced off his back and perfectly, better than the best low header. Sometimes the ball runs for you or it runs against you.
Mm.
I don't think, I mean, clearly England aren't a great team, but the ball didn't run for them this time.
What a season Godin is having.
Scored the winning goal for them, doesn't he?
Well, he scored the goal that won them the league against Barcelona, scored the first goal in the Champions League final, and that puts them through to the next round.
Mm, indeed so. All right, well, that was your Group D, and we'll just have a little bit of music, and now Group C.
This is the bit of the podcast you can skip or hum loudly over my voice until I stop talking. We've got a brand new Guardian Football channel on YouTube, which is home to all kinds of original video content, including a daily news show out every lunchtime, filling you in on all the best and funniest press and social media reaction to the night before, as well as previews of all the big games with a range of special guests. Check out youtube.com/Guardian Football.
World Cup Football Daily with AC Jimbo.
Two terrific matches on the Tuesday night. There was a chance of viewing Greece Ivory Coast and Japan Colombia. Now, Mikhail, you went with Greece Ivory Coast, which I felt to begin with was a bit controversial. But boy, were you rewarded with a sizzling finale.
Yeah, the last few minutes of the game were incredible. Greece aren't really good at football, this Greece team, but they have shown before that they can really pull off a result, and that was their intention in the whole game. And Ivory Coast really struggled with the pressure of Japan and Colombia before, and you felt that against Greece they would have a bit more space to play football in, but they weren't comfortable with that at all either. And a Tiota mistake gave Greece the lead, where instead of Samaras, substitute Samaris popped up with a great finish. And there was just a sense that even though this Greece team hasn't been a great collection of footballers, they could actually go and progress to the next round. And
What was that stat about the number of goals they've scored? Is it 2 in 9 World Cup matches now?
Yeah, they have scored in 2 matches of their last 9.
Brilliant.
At the World Cup, I believe.
Oh, yeah, because they got another one today.
If they score, they score two. Okay. But normally they don't score at all.
Right, okay.
That's pretty much where it is.
Well, the Samaris magic was Corona, wasn't it? Sang that. That wasn't the only, because that was the thing. They don't score much, but they were coming forward. They hit the woodwork repeatedly. Karagounis with an absolute, striker. Yeah, Sean Ingle would call it. And then Boney made it 1-1, and it looked as though Ivory Coast would be going through. But at the end, there was that penalty. Now, was it a penalty? I wasn't so sure. This was for Samaras.
Yeah.
The curious thing about doing minute by minute is that you only ever get to see things.
You were peddling.
You have to see things, then you're furiously typing to try and get your thoughts out. But when I first saw it, it looked to me like CO had got enough of Samaras to give away a penalty.
Right.
But as I said, I haven't seen it since.
I don't think it was. Listeners will have their own opinions, perhaps. But anyway, it was given, and he scored it under immense pressure. And there you go.
That was his first goal in 24 hours for Greece.
Mm. 24 hours of game time.
24 hours of game time.
Yeah. Remarkable. Here's another interesting stat. Wilfred Boney, his equaliser, was the 23rd goal scored by a substitute at World Cup 2014. Now, this isn't something that will ordinarily have caught my eye, except for the fact that there's been a real progression in terms of the number of substitutes scoring.
Is that because of the weather conditions?
I don't know. You know, is that fresh legs?
You'd imagine fresh legs would, in that heat, would, you know, be able to capitalise on defensive mistakes.
Very possibly, very possibly. Anyway, so Ivory Coast go out and Greece go through to an extraordinary last 16 match with Costa Rica, Simon.
I was just, while it looked like Greece were going out, I was doing some sums on the number of UEFA qualifiers to rounds of 16. It's always been very steady until the last couple of World Cups. So if the first ever round of 16 was in 1986, and World Cups, so there were 10 UEFA qualifiers in the round of 16 then. And in 1990, 10. In 94, there were 10. In 98, there were 10. In 2002, there were 9. In 2006, there were 10.
I mean, I could go on.
And then in the last World Cup, there were 6. And in this one, it looks like 5. Now, UEFA supremacy in football they're struggling to keep it up, aren't they? It's not just England, it's the whole ruddy continent.
Is this just a fragment of the kind of universal battle between Sepp Death Star and Obi-Wan Platini? Is it being played out across a World Cup, their struggle for power? Possibly so. I don't know.
Arguably.
It would explain a lot. That's interesting. And the South American teams now have a problem that they're all going to be fighting over one semi-final spot. You might have seen this. Brazil, Chile, Colombia and Uruguay, only one of them can make the semi-finals because of the way the draw works out. But Colombia, you wouldn't want to be facing them in the next round. And that is exactly what's going to happen to Uruguay. They looked absolutely sensational against Japan.
Yeah, they really looked like they weren't prepared to break any sweat, but still were quite comfortable in their victory. And the attacking talent they have at their disposal has been praised all over, even with the absence of Falcao. And
right.
Today you really saw why Colombia is a so-called dark horse for many people. One thing I'm not sure about is their defense, because they're in... Well, a weak group with not many star attackers that have tried to actually penetrate that defense. And they haven't been put under real pressure apart from a spell against Ivory Coast. And they have a few slow defenders in there, like Mario Yepes.
Yepes, who I think has had a good World Cup so far, no? But he's 38 now, isn't he?
Yeah, and that starts to show. Mm. And when you play against perhaps not Suarez, but at least Cavani or Abel Hernandez, he will have a tough time, I can imagine.
Mm. Talking of aging Colombians,
ooh,
Mondragon came on.
There you go.
With 5 minutes to go for an emotional and sentimental appearance in the World Cup, age 43. It was his birthday on Saturday.
There you go.
So, and he's now the oldest player ever to play in the World Cup. So, happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday indeed.
The second oldest?
He overtook Roger Miller, yeah. He was 42 back in 1994.
Jonathan Wilson tweeting, but I thought the Mondragons died out in the reign of Aegon III. We might speak to Jonathan later on. There were some great fans of that game. Can I just say, some great fans. The old fella painted completely yellow, who looked like I don't know what. And then the Japanese flag man... If you didn't see it, I don't know how to put it into words, but if you did, you'll know the man I'm talking about.
It's just lovely that they spend hours and hours at home before they go to the game.
Mm.
And it only falls into place when they actually enter the stadium. I mean, they look fools when they walk up to the game, probably.
The other thing I learned in this game, so Jackson Martinez became the first Colombian ever to score more than a single goal in a World Cup game, from which I learned the German word Ein Doppelpack.
Right, there you go.
Which is German for brace.
Right. Yeah, I feel we haven't actually cooed and ummed and ahed about their goals enough. Because
they were stylish, they were, weren't they?
Martinez's second was a brilliant curler.
Yeah.
But I think James Rodriguez was the pick of the bunch, no?
And I mean, it was absolutely wonderful. You're twisting this way and that, and then just where it looked like his only option was a low, hard shot across the keeper to the back stick, chipped it up over him.
I mean, as Mikhail was saying, they just look like they're doing it without even breaking sweat at the moment. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens.
Just to go back to the goals again,
mm-hmm.
Okazaki's header was a sensational technique.
Right.
And I didn't see the rest of the goals, but possibly just as good as the rest.
Mm. Maybe not, eh?
Yeah, arguably.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Hey, on the subject of goals, Fred scored on Monday, and yesterday we might have given the impression that we thought that he was offside, and a lot of people wrote in to say, what are you talking about? Apparently the replay had the offside line in the wrong place, and he was actually onside, so that explains that. And lots of people also posting in to say how disappointed they were that we're not giving enough time and attention to CONCACAF teams, and particularly we only gave 90 seconds apparently to Mexico and Croatia yesterday. Sorry about that. Try and do better than Mexico's next game. The legend of Manaus, Everard Santa Marina, says, has anyone noticed no one who plays there has won their next game? That doesn't bode well for USA, who of course take on Germany there, but then they might not need to win that game. Hardcore Prawn, did anyone else spot the Mexican fan dressed as Frida Kahlo? Did you see this?
No, I missed
That's quality, complete with flowers in her hair and a hopefully, in brackets, drawn-on monobrow. Wow, that's excellent, isn't it? Now, I think it's almost time for us to take a look at Wednesday's action. And next up, Jonathan Wilson explains Group F.
James, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm very well. Where are you, Jonathan?
I'm in the flat in Copacabana, and about to go out for some food.
Great. Well, that sounds nice. Are you going like to a little local place that's become a favourite?
No, we're going slightly further field. We're going to venture out four whole blocks, and there's a Rashinia there, a sort of big meat restaurant. But normally we don't get to eat till quite late, so I never really fancy a lot of meat, but with the games being early and not being out again today, I think I manage.
All right, that sounds great. Anyway, meaty action ahoy in Group F, where Argentina got two wins, not necessarily impressing both. So it's Argentina on 6, Nigeria on 4, Iran on 1, and Bosnia-Herzegovina on 0 points. Iran will go through to the last 16, Jonathan, for the first time in their history if they can beat BNH and Nigeria lose to Argentina. Is that what's going to happen?
I think they probably will beat Bosnia, yeah. I mean, Bosnia have been desperately disappointing. I think Susic will land the last game. Against Nigeria, really baffling. I mean, a baffling team selection. I mean, playing basically without a left back, putting Lulic there, and then Nigeria clearly were just pinging long diagonals over his head, and Musa was getting in there, and Emenike was getting in there, and Tupic didn't seem able to change that. Which, okay, you take a gamble, and maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. But it was obvious until 15-20 minutes it wasn't working, and he did nothing. So the question marks over him, and then apparently there's Lukšić in the Bosnian camp with Stahic, the left-sided centre-back, who had a terrible game, but I think, you know, he was exposed by the tactics. He's the captain. He and Tusic apparently had serious words after the game, so I think the mood isn't great in the Bosnian camp.
Not the first
question, though, is can Iran attack? I mean, we've seen them defend, but they do actually have to score.
Managerially speaking, then, you would see Iran under Carlos Queiroz as having a major advantage in this tussle.
In terms of that game, yeah, and I think that was always sort of the worry with Susic. So, you know, fantastic player, but tactically, was he really all that? Was Queiroz is brilliant tactician, certainly defensively. I think, you know, people like Patrice Evra, Gary Neville have said what a huge influence he had over Manchester United when he was the assistant there, particularly in Europe. Patrice Evra was talking about the semi-final of the Champions League in 2008 when they beat Barcelona 1-0 over two legs, and had Queiroz, you know, sorted out the defensive tactics of that game and got it perfect. And I think you saw, I mean, the, you know, the game against Argentina, I can't really see how they could have played that better. And in the end, you know, they're undone by a moment of genius, but they had 11 players behind the ball and Messi scored with that shot. So that was pretty much the only thing you could have done. And if that's what a team's relying on, then as a coach, then you've done your job.
But you, nothing but admiration for the job he's done there at Iran.
Yeah, and I think if you consider, I mean, you know, the level of play that he has, where those players play, the difficulties he's had with the sanctions, with lack of funding from the government, I think it's been extremely difficult for him, and in the circumstances, I think he's done brilliantly.
When you mention this, the sanctions relates principally to the teams they can play against in terms of preparations, but the lack of funding, is it true then, this notion that the Iranian government has almost tried to not undermine the team, but they haven't really committed to what they see as almost a seditious form of sporting behaviour playing football. Is that right?
Well, that's certainly how Queiroz sees it. I mean, I haven't done any investigation into it, but that's certainly the way he perceives it. I think the sanctions also, I mean, you know, as you say, made it very difficult in terms of arranging friendlies and where they can play. I think even in terms of getting equipment and things that they need, it makes everything a bit more complicated. And that possibly explains to an extent the government's attitude, if Queiroz is right, that it might actually not be a deliberate policy, it might just be it's so difficult that everything gets held up and then sort of incompetence takes over.
And they don't have enough jerseys to swap shirts with any of their opponents, so the story goes. But there you go,
there's some bizarre story that they were wearing fake Ursport shirts that shrank in the wash, which, again, I mean, yeah, I've got no idea of that history. That's certainly a rumour that's sort of circulating around.
All right. Well, it's a bit of a worry then if they're going to go into the knockout stages, because they're not sure if they budgeted enough jerseys for that. But if they do get the win against Bosnia-Herzegovina and Nigeria lose to Argentina, as I say, they'll be in the last 16. So what about Nigeria-Argentina?
Well, I guess what might happen there is that they might play that out from a mutually beneficial draw. I mean, Argentina will want to top the group. They probably play Switzerland or Ecuador in the second round in San Paolo, so that's clearly a relatively attractive proposition rather than having to play France, assuming France top group B. So I'm not suggesting that they'll agree a draw beforehand, but certainly I think if it's 0-0 or 1-1 with 20 minutes to go, half an hour to go, then there'll be sort of nods and that game will be announced. And I think in some ways, I think it's quite likely. I think Argentina is still sort of a little bit, there's a little bit of insecurity there because they haven't played well yet. So, yeah, I think their first instinct would be to keep things tight, safety first. And Keshi, Stephen Keshi, the Nigeria coach, I think he's actually very, very good at closing games. And people complaining, I saw a lot of Bosnian fans complaining after the Bosnian-Nigeria game that it seemed that Bosnia weren't trying, that there was no effort there. Well, if you've watched Nigeria the last couple of years, this happened in a couple of nations as well, that Ivory Coast in the quarterfinal in South Africa last year, they just couldn't get going. The Keshi just shut them down so well that it appeared they were playing with great lassitude, but actually they're just sort of in a tactical net and they can't get out. So I think Keshi will probably start defensively as well. So it wouldn't surprise me if that's a pretty dull 0-0 or 1-1 and both teams quite happy. So that's the danger for them. But all they can do is win that game and hope.
Jonathan Wilson in Rio de Janeiro. So there you go, Nigeria, Argentina and Bosnia-Herzegovina against Iran, which will be going on simultaneously, those two games. It sounds like the Iran game might be the one to stay tuned to. But, of course, there's also action on Wednesday from Group E. France, who are very much leading the way here, on 6 points. Then you've got Ecuador and Switzerland on 3. Switzerland, whose goal difference is 2 worse than Ecuador's. And then Honduras on nothing at all. But they're still in with a chance. Still in with a chance. Ecuador are playing France at the Maracanã. And Honduras take on Switzerland. That game at the Maracanã has got the two top goal scorers. Oh, they may not be actually anymore. But that game in the Maracanã has got Benzema and Ener Valencia going head-to-head in a kind of goal fest thing. A battle of potential golden boot people.
Talking of goal fests.
Oh, yeah.
Honduras-Switzerland meet on the fourth anniversary. It was exactly on the 25th of June in 2010 when they played out their dull 0-0 draw in Bloemfontein.
Oh.
So I'm not exactly talking of goal fest, and I'm kind of changing the subject in a manner of speaking. But there you go. Switzerland have been much more interesting this World Cup, though.
They have, haven't they? They've got Van Bergen out with a broken face, poor chap. And they might have more on the way, because Honduras like to get stuck in, don't they? They've had 6 cards in 2 games. They're averaging 14.5 fouls a game, which is a healthy average.
Yeah, and Switzerland have conceded as many goals in their 2 previous games in this World Cup as in all 9 previous games in all their previous World Cups.
Really? But then a lot of that is just the 5 that they shipped against France, isn't it?
Indeed, approximately 5/9 of that is the 5 they shipped against.
Well, talking about goals per game, how about 16-3? 5, 6, France 7. Are averaging more than 5 goals a game in their last 3 matches. That's an astonishing statistic.
Yeah, Benzema's been great, hasn't he?
Hmm?
Benzema's been great. Yeah, I think that a lot of people just see him as a goal scorer, but he's a really intelligent footballer too, the way he picks out his teammates.
Mm. What about, since we're discovering hidden dimensions to players, what about Olivier Giroud on the, I can't remember which goal it was, against Switzerland, but the one where he started it off in pretty much his own area, then ran the entire length of the field in time to get on the end of it, and it was a stirring run. Everyone's been quite impressed with France. Mikhail, were you expecting them to be this good?
Well, 2 years ago, I expected them to be really good because they always have a very good squad when you look at the individual players. And it's always the question if it can really come together. But in this form, I think they're one of the few sides in the competition that actually lacks a real weak spot. I mean, the Netherlands lack has a bit of defensive solidity. Germany lack a striker. And are a bit suspicious at the back as well, and that goes for a lot of these teams. But France, they just look very complete, and very threatening. And if they start scoring goals like they did against Switzerland, it will be very tough to stop them.
No Kabay in this game. Matthew Valbuena will be busy in midfield. Some question marks about whether Sacco is going to be fit as well. But you would still, I'm guessing, make France strong favourites against Ecuador. What about Honduras, Switzerland? Do you want to call that?
You'd think Switzerland would have enough to do that.
Yeah. Well, if Switzerland do go through, they'll probably be facing Argentina. And if France do go through as group winners, then they'll be facing Iran. Boy, that'll be some match.
Or Nigeria.
Yeah, or Nigeria. Hmm. Actually, that's fair. It's not probably Iran at all, is it?
I think Iran are going to do it.
You think they're going to do it, Ian?
Yeah, I'm doing the minute by minute tomorrow night, so I was...
was boning up on a bit of Iran knowledge during the day.
Mm.
I feel like they've got the defensive solidity to do it, and they might just catch one on the break.
How about this? They completed only 53 passes in the first half against Argentina.
Was that less than Mascherano produced?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's the lowest tally recorded by a team for any half at any World Cup since records began.
I do know that they only scored 8 goals in qualifying, and 4 of them came against Lebanon in the second stage of qualifying. So they're not really prolific up front.
Mm-mm. They did do some attacking against Argentina.
They certainly did.
They didn't simply defend for that 0-0 draw. So there's not a complete lack of optimism there. And Bosnia have been playing disappointingly. They played disappointingly against Nigeria, obviously. But again, against Argentina, they looked pretty tasty. And they scored a lot of goals in qualifying. So, I mean, why will that not potentially
take heart from Greece, of course?
Yeah.
So, and they only need one goal if Argentina score 2 against Nigeria. So,
I've not got my wall chart handy, so I don't know if Greece and Iran can meet at any time soon in the World Cup. But that could be quite a tasty encounter. But that's something to think of another day, because another World Cup Football Daily has come to an end. But it sounds like we've got an exceptional Wednesday lined up. Do join us to discuss what happens in those matches Wednesday night, Thursday morning. In the meantime, many thanks to Mikael Jongsma, Simon Burton, and Ian McCourt, and producer Ben. And we'll catch up with you Thursday morning.
World Cup Football Daily, just like being in Brazil.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. With World Cup fever taking over, we at The Guardian are pretty sure that you're thinking big too. So maybe now is the time to use Squarespace to create your own professional website for your small business, portfolio, or blog. It's easy. You could create your own site during halftime. Just go to squarespace.com to start your free trial. And to support this podcast, use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.